This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the New Yorker Hour. It's coming up 15 months since the Norfolk Southern derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. We don't hear a lot about it anymore, but things are still in dire circumstances. A report was posted at thenewyorker.com on April 19th. East Palestine after the crash. More than a year after a train derailment and chemical fire in Ohio that made international news, residents contend with lingering sickness, uncertainty, and for some, a desire to just move on. Norfolk Southern and government officials decided to release and burn more than 100,000 gallons of vinyl chloride, a toxic gas. In late January, Jamie Wallace and her husband Chris took a road trip to Washington, D.C. on business. These days, the couple has so little time alone that they thought of the drive, 4.5 hours from their home in eastern Ohio, as a date. They smoked cigarettes and hummed along with "Try That in a Small Town," Jason Aldean's country anthem. Wallace told me he was saying, "We country folk will fight back. We're like, this is our theme song." When they arrived in D.C., they had to show the hotel valet how to turn their car, a battered Ford Fusion, on and off with a pair of pliers. The key had broken in the ignition a month before. Wallace said, "I should have just got out like nothing was wrong," and smiled and handed him the pliers. The next day, they joined a group of activists for a meeting on the Council on Environmental Quality, an advisory body at the White House. It was yet another chance for Wallace to explain what was happening in our community, the illnesses, the noxious chemicals. On their way back home, the car broke down, stranding her and Chris at a gas station in Maryland. Her stepfather, who also lives in Ohio, drove overnight to get them. Wallace caught a couple of hours of sleep, then made her way to a political rally at the First Church of Christ, a sand-colored triangle with a decorative white steeple in East Palestine. The audience was too big for a sunny weekday afternoon in a town of fewer than 5,000 people. Wallace took a seat in the front row. Rick Tsai, a local chiropractor, was running a long-shot campaign to represent Ohio's 6th District in Congress. He stepped up to a wooden lectern and rambled through a list that combined MAGA principles with an eco-protective streak rather specific to East Palestine: safer chemical transport, free health care for residents and first responders, and federal location funds. Wallace cheered and nodded so vigorously that a rust-colored ponytail bobbed up and down. These days, she's a single-issue voter. When Tsai took a break and invited questions, she spoke up from her chair. She praised him for his volunteer work, which included monitoring the condition of the neighborhood creeks. He was unlike the politicians who sit up on the hill and play politics with my daughter's life. "With everybody's life in this room," she said. A year earlier, the tiny village of East Palestine had become world famous. On February 3, 2023, a long eastbound train operated by Norfolk Southern tumbled off the tracks near downtown. 38 rail cars, including 11 filled with chemicals, derailed. No one was injured, but small fires burned and residents in the immediate area, including Wallace and her family, were told to evacuate. At the crash site, the village fire department, mostly a volunteer squad, was joined by federal and state environmental workers and crisis managers and engineers from the railroad. 3 days later, officials with Norfolk Southern and the government decided to puncture holes in some of the cars containing vinyl chloride, a cancer-causing substance used to make plastic pipes. They drained more than 100,000 gallons of the toxin into ditches, then set the mass on fire. This vent and burn was needed to prevent an explosion, they said. A huge black cloud shot up and lingered, blocking the sun. 2 days after that, the village lifted the evacuation order and invited residents to return. Wallace, Chris, and their toddler, Kyla, had evacuated to a hotel across the state line in West Virginia. When the order was lifted, Wallace briefly returned to East Palestine to pick up a prescription medicine they'd left behind and was overwhelmed by a noxious smell. A creek that feeds the Ohio River flowed through their front yard of the stone house they were renting. Kyla and her dad had collected frogs and poked at shiny pebbles on the property. "It was our little piece of the country in the city," Wallace told me. "Now you just saw chemicals going down the creek. It's almost looked like vegetable oil on top of the water." Later, an environmental tester hired by Norfolk Southern noticed a liquid residue on the home's basement walls. Wallace left nearly everything behind, including old family photos. She explained, "Anything fabric or porous, chemicals leach into." Jamie Wallace, the president of the Unity Council for East Palestine, believes that the derailment and the deliberate burn-off of vinyl chloride have poisoned the area and made people sick. The derailment had destroyed a stretch of track, but Norfolk Southern quickly relayed and resumed business. Only when residents protested did the company divert its trains and start to truck out contaminated water and soil. Norfolk distributed inconvenience checks of $1,000 per person. Other expenses seemed to be reimbursed at random. Wallace received $2,500 to cover ruined furniture. Someone else she knew got $7,500. Government scientists tested East Palestine's dirt, water, and air and insisted that life could go on as before. Mike DeWine, governor of Ohio, drank tap water from a resident's kitchen on TV. Ohio's health department set up a free primary care clinic, although it didn't screen for vinyl chloride. The village had to rely on the expertise offered by outside recovery agencies and by Norfolk Southern, which plied the community with donations. The Wallaces gave up their lease and in June moved into a pricier rental in East Liverpool, which is nearby. They occasionally went to East Palestine to see family, but whenever they did, they felt sick. Their friends and relatives who stayed behind reported headaches, blurry vision, nosebleeds, rashes, and coughs, known symptoms of exposure to vinyl chloride and other chemicals. Federal investigators fell ill on brief visits to the site. Tsai, who lives on the edge of East Palestine with his wife, developed welts on his back. There had been no full accounting of which chemicals had spilled and combusted or what their effects were on human health. It was hard to believe that homes and businesses could be safe so soon after the fire. Wallace felt that the village government, propped up by the railroad, had chosen to stop asking questions and was pressuring residents to move back and move on. Wallace told me, "We live in the village of Norfolk Southern now." East Palestine was christened by 19th century settlers who wished to invoke the Holy Land. Within a few decades of their arrival, a train line was built through the village, which sits between the historic steel centers of Youngstown and Pittsburgh. Nearby is Norfolk Southern's Conway Yard, one of the largest rail yards in the country, and the intended destination of the train that derailed. More than 50,000 train cars pass through Conway every month. You can hear freight trains from just about everywhere in East Palestine. Traffic is often stopped at a crossing downtown. Nowadays, the village's largest employer is Threshold Residential Services, a charity that functions similarly to Goodwill. Many of the area's steel plants have disappeared, but various petrochemical concerns have arisen in their place. There's a hazardous waste incinerator in East Liverpool, where the Wallaces live, a power plant a short drive away, and a new ethylene cracker plant for making plastics, owned by Shell, across the Pennsylvania border. A straight shot south in West Virginia, coal mining continues. Living in Appalachia comes with an awareness and grudging tolerance of some amount of pollution. The drinking water in parts of southern and eastern Ohio has been found to contain carcinogenic forever chemicals far in excess of the limits set by the EPA. 80% of water systems in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, have shown the presence of lead. There are elevated rates of hypertension and childhood asthma throughout the region. In the wake of the Norfolk Southern crash, Wallace became an informal clearinghouse for symptom reports at public meetings and on social media. She told me, "There's residents you've never met coming up to you and saying, 'My husband's on oxygen, and my kids are coughing up blood.'" She connected with neighbors in East Palestine and Western Pennsylvania and helped form an advocacy organization called the Unity Council. Members of the council wanted information and accountability. In addition to their immediate health problems, they understood the bewildering timescale of chemical exposures, that cancers and other ailments could take decades to emerge. Some neighbors thought that Wallace and the rest of the Unity Council were overreacting. John Varley and his wife Rebecca, who owns Nini's Collectibles, a gift shop in East Palestine, evacuated briefly after the derailment, then returned. They accepted the inconvenience fee from Norfolk Southern as a sufficient recompense for what John called a temporary chemical irritation in their throats. He told me, "These chemicals have been flowing through here for years and years." He believed that the railroad and local government were doing their best to make amends. Shortly after the crash, regional staff from the EPA arrived. Mark Durno grew up near East Palestine and supervises the agency's emergency response in the area. He told me that they had worried most about the vinyl chloride and acrylates. "We have this vent and burn, and a cloud is created from that operation," he said. "On top of that, we had over 5 miles of creek heavily contaminated. We're dealing with a slew of different classes of chemicals. We're dealing with a few chemicals that we don't have a lot of toxicology history on." East Palestine stood out to him as uniquely complex, though he emphasized that the EPA was holding Norfolk Southern accountable. The corporation bore primary responsibility for the cleanup. A spokesman for Norfolk Southern reiterated the company's investments in East Palestine and referred me to a website that the company set up called Making It Right. In the past year of testing, the EPA has not found vinyl chloride or acrylates above levels of concern in or near East Palestine, Durno told me. Despite these conclusions, members of the Unity Council believe that their ailments are a direct result of the seepage and the ignition of toxic chemicals. Wallace explained, "I was at a meeting where Mark Durno said that they found chemicals in that creek that could not be traced back to any industry in the area." Then in an email, he told her that the contaminants were a mixture of legacy compounds and derailment-related compounds. The term legacy, in Wallace's view, was meant to refute the contention that the derailment had poisoned the ecosystem, at least beyond whatever poison was already there. An analog existed when it came to human health. Lauren McIntosh, a nurse practitioner at the state-funded East Palestine Clinic, told me, "We're in the heart of Appalachia, and there are a lot of patients who maybe have not sought primary care for years. If, before the derailment, they developed conditions such as lung disease or asthma, their symptoms would be exacerbated by exposure to inflammatory chemicals. Wallace and other members of the Unity Council had met with Senators J.D. Vance and Sherrod Brown, who introduced a bipartisan Railway Safety Act that would force carriers transporting hazardous materials to establish emergency safety plans and meet stricter requirements on train length and speed. The Council exchanged tactics with other chemically impacted communities around the U.S. and joined calls for the EPA to ban vinyl chloride. So far, these efforts haven't amounted to much. On the weekend marking the first anniversary of the derailment, signs installed along the creek still warned, "Keep out, testing and cleaning in progress." Downtown, an EPA community welcome center was only open by appointment. Taggart Street, which runs parallel to the railroad track, resembled a giant construction zone, cloudy with the dust of countless trucks hauling contaminated soil. In the aftermath of the accident, people living nearby described a disgusting metallic taste in the air and creeks that looked slick with chemicals. On the anniversary weekend, I met Wallace and her husband outside their former home in East Palestine. It was sunny and warm. The creek sparkled. Chris was working odd jobs, and Wallace, who'd spent most of her career in Cleveland as an office manager and a leader of her union, was now a full-time, unpaid organizer with the Unity Council. Their daughter, Kyla, had picked up her habits, playing activist and parroting the names of toxic chemicals. They avoided bringing her into East Palestine to prevent further exposure. But, Wallace said, "My mom's still here. My nieces are still here." Kyla was missing out on barbecues and swimming dates, on the life I wanted for her. I attended a flurry of anniversary events, which were split between East Palestine and Columbiana, about 10 miles northwest. There were a few TV crews and provocative yard signs. "Hey, Biden, what the hell? East Palestine, we won't be derailed." But the mood around town was subdued, and only a small number of residents took part in the activities. Wallace sent me a schedule that included an environmental film festival, presentations by doctors and research scientists, an art installation, and a community vigil. It was a chance to unite, reflect, and honor the perseverance of those affected by the derailment, one press release said. Trent Conaway, the Republican mayor of East Palestine, held a press conference to launch a new logo and website for the village, a rebranding effort funded by Norfolk Southern. "As a community, we've shown resilience and unity," he said. The village's focus was on moving forward and taking control of our narrative through economic development. With some $46 million from Norfolk Southern, there'd soon be a new park, a rail depot, and a high-tech training facility for first responders. A promotional video announced the village motto, "Pride, Tradition, Progress." The next day at McKim's Honey Vine, a new winery in East Palestine, Sikh residents spoke before an audience mostly composed of environmental activists from other states. At the front of the room, Christina Sisiloff, a member of the Unity Council who lives in the Pennsylvania woods with her father and son, described the downwind aftermath of the derailment. "There was a disgusting metallic taste in the air," she said, "and there were dead frogs, fish, and a chemical sheen in the local creek." Rob Twohawks, a 72-year-old who has lived most of his life a few blocks from the crash site, fled to the high school gymnasium when the evacuation was ordered. Afterward, he told me, "I felt like I hit a brick wall. I went to walk and I couldn't, and I've never experienced that before." In a CDC survey of more than 700 residents conducted in the 2 months following the accident, more than half reported coughing, headaches, burning in the eyes, and difficulty breathing. The Environmental Film Festival was hosted at the Main Street Theater in Columbiana. Between screenings, the celebrity Echo Crusader Aaron Brockovich appeared virtually in a commercial to recruit plaintiffs for a lawsuit against Norfolk Southern. The program, a motley lineup of short films, was billed ambitiously as inaugural, but most of the velvet seats were empty. I was one of three people in the audience for most of the morning. During a break, I found Wallace in the lobby where phlebotomists representing a medical lab at the University of California, San Diego, collected blood samples. Researchers had come in from all over the country to introduce their studies on post-derailment health and invite residents to participate. Frederick Schumacher, an epidemiologist at Case Western University who investigates the linkages between chemical exposure and chronic illness, discussed how genetic predisposition could explain why some locals were getting sick while others were perfectly fine. Cancers might take years to show up, he said. An independent tester and businessman named Scott Smith, who'd befriended Wallace and other residents, spoke from the stage of the theater with much greater certainty. I'm the chosen one on the front lines, he said, identifying himself as a whistleblower. He claimed that the soil samples he had taken in East Palestine revealed much higher rates of toxins than any government agency had found. Durno, who first encountered Smith in 2016 during the drinking water crisis in Flint, Michigan, told me that Smith's data did not meet scientific standards, but acknowledged a trust gap between the EPA and a section of the community. He told me, the way I look at it is, we have slightly different goals. EPA's goal is to clean up the environment and ensure there's no ongoing risks to human health. On the community side, they demand justice. Smith was charismatic, and it was easy to see why some locals trusted him. Every day, their intuition contradicted pronouncements by village, state, and federal officials that things were normal. The derailment and the controlled burn had changed people's lives in irrevocable and puzzling ways. It might have been different if the authorities had admitted, as one environmental advocacy group recently wrote, that the scientific understanding does not exist to explain what is happening to the health of the people in East Palestine. Just before the anniversary of the train derailment, the White House announced that President Biden would visit East Palestine sometime in February. He had declined to do so in the immediate aftermath of the crash, a decision exploited by Donald Trump, who appeared at a fire station with J.D. Vance and took credit for the entire federal response. Wallace saw Biden as a last high-profile source of help. She came to East Palestine the morning of his visit to stand on the street and express her wish for a declaration of a federal emergency, which would drive an array of funds to residents. Her husband stayed home in East Liverpool. "He's fed up with this," she told me. Biden received a brief walking tour of the derailment site from Conaway, the mayor. He gave a speech lauding intergovernmental efforts to test and clean up the area and reserved all his scorn for Norfolk Southern. The accident was an act of greed that was 100% preventable, Biden said. He went on, "We're pushing railroads to take more precautions, to deal with braking, to deal with a whole range of things that were not dealt with." Only three workers had been on board the train that derailed. As videos later showed, one of its wheels had caught fire more than 20 miles earlier. Either no one noticed or the conductor was told to keep the train moving anyway. Railroad workers and unions have linked the East Palestine disaster to precision scheduling railroading, a management technique that squeezes longer, heavier trains run by fewer people into shorter timetables. Just months before the derailment, the nation's rail unions had prepared to strike over such practices, but Biden intervened to stop them. In November, voters in Cincinnati approved the sale of America's last city-owned rail line to Norfolk Southern. The railroads are being run by BlackRock, Vanguard, and Fidelity. The big shareholders are calling the shots, a worker at the Conway Rail Yard in Pennsylvania told me. He went on, maybe Norfolk Southern is trying to make it right with what happened, but are they trying to prevent it from happening again is the real question. Conway appeared uncomfortable at the press event, standing next to a president he hadn't endorsed, listening to an anti-corporate message so at odds with his own. The U.S. Department of Justice in the state of Ohio have filed lawsuits against Norfolk Southern, but neither East Palestine nor Columbia County has sued the railroad. Chad Edwards, East Palestine city manager, told me, so far Norfolk Southern is doing what they can. They've been very cooperative. We've talked about roads we need repaired. They've not said no to anything. Biden acknowledged that there's more to do, but he also sought to reassure residents that the air, water, and soil quality were being carefully monitored. He announced that 6 federal research grants would be awarded to study the short and long-term impacts of what happened here. Schumacher of Case Western was one of the grantees. Still, Wallace was disappointed. She said, I started crying. It was the final nail in the coffin. The EPA says everything's fine, but our body tells us something different. She had judged, perhaps correctly, that Biden's visit marked the end of what had been a year of national interest in her community. Ohio had trended so red that it was barely a swing state anymore, and pollution in the region was hardly novel. And yet it seemed to her anyone who paid attention would see trouble. In early March, another Norfolk Southern train derailed, toppling onto a riverbank in Pennsylvania. Sherrod Brown, who's facing an uncertain re-election campaign, came through East Palestine. So did Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who filed one of the many lawsuits against Norfolk Southern. His fellow long-shot candidate in the presidential race, Jill Stein, spoke with residents in nearby Darlington, Pennsylvania. The one politician that I met that I really fell in love with was RFK Jr., Wallace told me. He was like, we have these captive agencies and the EPA doesn't do what the EPA is supposed to do, and everything's controlled by money. Tsai continued to campaign on the derailment, but was outspent by 2 sitting legislators with more conventional platforms and lost badly in the primary. Conway started a dumpster business, capitalizing on the steady demand for waste management. The community has been split over the consequences of the derailment for public health and the local economy. In early April, Norfolk Southern agreed to pay $600 million in a comprehensive class action settlement, covering individuals and businesses within a certain radius of the accident, which is still subject to court approval. The settlement would also release Norfolk Southern from future liability. Wallace, who had started working as a patient recruiter for a lab in UC San Diego, called it ridiculous. She told me, how are you settling when people are still sick? Our creeks are still contaminated. If down the line residents develop cancer from exposure to vinyl chloride or some other chemical, they'd have to pay for their own treatment, which could cost far more than what anyone gets now. Recently, Wallace was helping to organize a new coalition for the chemically impacted when her phone lit up with a startling piece of news. Jennifer Homendy, the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, which had judged the derailment 100% preventable and has been reviewing its causes, testified that the decision to burn the vinyl chloride had been improper. According to Norfolk Southern, this had prevented a potentially catastrophic, uncontrolled explosion. Humendy said that the manufacturer of the vinyl chloride, Oxy Vinyls, had told Norfolk that there was no justification to do a vent and burn, but was then left out of the room when decisions were being made. The NTSB's full report will be out in June. Wallace told me, "It was kind of hard to hear, even though we've known that. You secretly hope that you're wrong." This article by E. Tammy Kim. She is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. One of the major things going on now is protests taking place at colleges and universities over events in the Middle East. They're often compared to the anti-Vietnam protests of the 1960s. The New Yorker's J. Caspian Kang analyzes one of these events and then asks if perhaps it is masking a deeper situation. Posted at thenewyorker.com on April 19th, when a pro-free speech dean shuts down a student protest. An online argument erupted after a video of a law professor grabbing a microphone from a student went viral. But the debate has obscured some fairly basic truths. Viral videos demand context, but sometimes the stories behind the clip seem to obscure what we can already see. Last week, footage circulated of a dispute in a backyard. A young woman wearing a red hijab stands in a garden stairway with a microphone in her hand. "Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Peace and blessings upon you all," she says. A moment later, off camera, a man's voice pleads, "Please leave. No, please leave. Please leave. This is my house." An older man in a gray sweater appears in front of the speaker, his arms crossed. The speaker ignores him. "Tonight is also the last night of the holy month of Ramadan," she continues. Then a woman in a white blouse and a black skirt arrives on the stairs, grabs the microphone, and puts her arm around the speaker's shoulder. "Leave. This is not your house," the woman in the black skirt says. "It is my house." She tugs at the microphone with her left hand and grabs the speaker's shoulder with her right. "Please do not touch me," the speaker says. "This is my First Amendment right." The two women have some back and forth about the First Amendment before the woman in the black skirt tries again to wrestle the microphone away. They struggle awkwardly, moving up the stairs. Then the speaker agrees to leave if the woman in the skirt will return the microphone. Within days, the incident in the garden has been commented upon by countless legal journalists and professors on social media and had got written up in multiple major newspapers. At first glance, deciding who is in the wrong seems simple enough. The woman in the skirt should not have put her hands on the speaker, who, at that point, had simply offered a greeting and noted that it was the last night of Ramadan. But, as with all viral videos, there is both a context and a story behind what we see, and they are worth understanding not only to decide whether there's another way to look at what happened, but also to grasp how context functions when it comes to controversies in the news, and who gets to decide what details matter. The garden sits in the Tony Rockridge neighborhood of Oakland, California. It belongs to a married couple. Edwin Cherminsky, who is the dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law, and Catherine Fisk, a progressive labor scholar who also teaches at the law school. Fisk is the woman in the black skirt. Chemerinsky is the man in the sweater. The speaker in the red hijab is a student, Malak Afaneh, a 24-year-old Palestinian-American third-year student and co-president of the Berkeley Chapter of Law Students for Justice in Palestine, or LSJP. One way to tell the story of the video is to begin in the fall of 2022, when Afaneh realized that, just as other student groups had bylaws forbidding white supremacists from talking at their events, the LSJP could ban Zionists from speaking at the ones it held, and that it could encourage other groups to do the same. Zionism, Afaneh told me, is a form of racism and a form of settler colonialism, and such a bylaw was consistent, she believed, with the logic of the Boycott Divestment Sanctions, or BDS, movement, which aims to put cultural and economic pressure on Israel by cutting ties with Israel institutions. Afaneh said, BDS is not only about material boycott, it's also about academic boycott. It's ensuring that people who believe in settler colonialism and genocide are not being invited into spaces and making other students feel unsafe. Chemerinsky, who co-authored a book about campus free speech in 2017, which argued that even hate speech must be protected, heard about the LSJP bylaw on the first day of classes that semester. His initial response, he told me, was, "Oh, shit." He'd already been disturbed by the trend among campus activists across the country to shut down speakers they did not like, he said. And though he recognized that barring Zionist speakers was not the same as excluding Jewish people generally, he believed that the bylaw was inconsistent with the position that all ideas and views can be expressed and should be expressed. He also realized that the bylaw, if enforced, forbade him from speaking at LSJP events because he supports the existence of Israel. There were calls from some students and faculty members at the law school to prohibit the bylaw or defund the LSJP as well as the other groups that adopted it, but Chemerinsky maintained that student organizations had a First Amendment right to invite or disinvite whomever they wanted. He took the same position regarding guidelines enacted more than a decade before by Hillel International, a Jewish student organization, which precluded hosting events that featured anti-Zionist speakers. Predictably enough, this stance satisfied basically no one. A few weeks into the semester, the lawyer and scholar Kenneth L. Marcus wrote a piece for the Jewish Journal headlined, "Berkeley Develops Jewish Free Zones." The piece helped turn an intercampus dispute into a viral fight that got attention from national politicians and Barbara Streisand, among others. Chemerinsky did not reverse his position, but he did sign a public letter written by two of his colleagues, Stephen Davidoff Solomon and Mark G. Udoff, which condemned the bylaw as discriminatory and argued that many Jews experience the bylaw as anti-Semitism because it denies the existence of the State of Israel, the historic home of the Jewish people. The letter adds, "For many Jews, Zionism is a core component of their identity and ethnic and ancestral heritage." Chemerinsky's decision to sign the letter evoked mixed reactions from his colleagues. Even some who agreed that the views expressed in the letter believed that Chemerinsky, as the dean of the law school, should have remained neutral on the issue. Solomon, for his part, disagrees. The students had taken steps that our dean not only rightly called anti-Semitic, but which fundamentally denied Jewish students their self-identity, he told me. What is a law school for if it's not against illiberalism? Then, 8 days after October 7th, Solomon published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal titled, "Don't Hire My Anti-Semitic Law Students." He argued that student organizations that adopted the LSJP bylaw were engaging in anti-Semitism and dehumanizing Jews, and were part of the broader attitude against Jews on university campuses that made last week's massacre possible. He advised employers to ask students which organizations they belonged to, and not to hire members of groups that had endorsed the bylaw. In response, more than 200 alumni of the law school signed an open letter addressed to Chemerinsky, insisting that Solomon's directive harms free speech and threatens the safety and livelihoods of students. Chemerinsky, in turn, defended Solomon's freedom of speech, saying that professors have a right to express their personal opinions. He also noted that Solomon was not speaking for the law school, which, he said, is committed to helping all students secure jobs. Chemerinsky also published an op-ed of his own in the Los Angeles Times. He wrote, "I have heard few campus administrators speak out publicly about the anti-Semitism that has become prevalent this month. They want to seem neutral or not be perceived as Islamophobic. I understand. I, too, refrain from speaking out against those who defended Hamas terrorist attack. But when do we stop being silent, and when do we say the anti-Semitism must be condemned, and it is not acceptable on our campuses? I believe this must be that time." In January, the conservative nonprofit Accuracy and Media drove a truck near the school with the names of people, including Berkeley students, whom the group accused of engaging in anti-Semitism. Chemerinsky condemned the nonprofit and its truck. He said, "Its harassment of our students is loathsome, and I condemn it in the strongest possible terms. It is an attempt to intimidate students for their speech that is protected by the First Amendment." All of this was in the background when, in March, Chemerinsky announced that third-year law students would be invited to a series of dinners held at the dean's home. After the announcement, Berkeley LSJP created a poster denouncing the parties. It read, "No dinner with Zionist Chem while Gaza starves," along with an illustration of Chemerinsky holding a bloody fork and knife with crumbs on his face. The group distributed the poster on campus and posted a picture of it on Instagram. One needn't have much knowledge of the history of blood libel to recognize the image immediately as anti-Semitic, or to understand the effect that the poster might have not only on Jewish students and faculty, but on anyone who does not want to see bigoted images on their campus. Chemerinsky told me that some people in the law school wanted the posters ripped down from the walls, and he had asked that they be kept up to respect First Amendment rights of his students. He also said the posters indicated a continued failure among the broader campus community to recognize the problem of anti-Semitism. He told me, "I think if there was a similar poster about a black dean with exaggerated African features, there would have been a much larger outcry." Chemerinsky said that most of the complaints he received about the posters were from Jewish students and staff. Sympathy and outrage from others seemed to be lacking. He said, "I was just sad. My main reaction to the poster was just, it really made me really sad." The poster, he added, was essential context for understanding what happened later in his garden. Since the video of the garden incident went viral, there's been a lengthy and somewhat pedantic online debate about whether or not Afanay's constitutional rights were violated, and whether the dinner, which was held on private property but was an official university function, should be seen as a protected area under the First Amendment. According to many of the constitutional scholars who've weighed in, and it feels like most of them have. Chemerinsky's home is not a free speech zone, even if it's being utilized for a law school event. I will leave that debate to the scholars, not because it is uninteresting, but because, as every free speech pedant will remind you, there's a difference between the specific legal scope of the First Amendment and the broader spirit of free speech and expression. Throughout his career, Chemerinsky has shown an admirable concern with the latter. Wouldn't someone who believes in the sanctity of student speech allow a protest to continue at a school function, even if that protest took place on private property? When I asked Chemerinsky this, he said that nobody has the right to disrupt activities or interrupt another speaker. Afene did not shout down anyone. She spoke while other students were eating, and at the moment when she was interrupted by Chemerinsky and Fisk, she had simply wished everyone a happy Ramadan. As a member of a racial minority whose sufferings get routinely overlooked in America, I sympathized with Chemerinsky's despair about the lack of outrage within the law school community in regard to the poster. But I was struck that Chemerinsky, who describes himself as a supporter of Palestinian rights, would compare his situation to that of a hypothetical black teen, while seeming less willing or able to simply put himself in Afanez's position as a 24-year-old student whose people were being bombed in front of the world with the unconditional support of the United States. How would he feel if the person shepherding his education, someone who was widely beloved for his fairness and goodwill, appeared to call him out in a national newspaper? Would he feel like he had the support of the school he attended? Would he accept that his dean was saying those things merely as an individual and not on behalf of the institution? Should he? Generally, people don't launch protests when they feel like their concerns are being addressed or when they can call up the Los Angeles Times and get an op-ed published. They protest when they feel silenced, when they feel like the institutions that they are part of have turned against them. Afene, of course, has her own context to add. She says that she and other students on campus felt targeted by Chemerinsky's op-ed and what they regard as his insistence that anyone who did not support the existence of Israel was anti-Semitic. She said the remarks she had planned were inspired by similar remarks delivered at the University of Melbourne, where a group of Muslim students, invited to an iftar dinner during Ramadan, protested the war in Gaza. Those students, Afanas said, had silently walked out of the dinner one by one. Before members of the LSJP left Chemerinsky's home, Afanas was going to give a 2.5-minute speech, the text of which she shared with me. It ends with a quote from Basel al-Arraj, a Palestinian activist who was killed in a gunfight outside of Ramallah in 2017. "If you want to be an intellectual, you must be entangled. If you do not wish to be entangled, then there is no use for you or your intellectualism." As for the poster, Afanas said the image of Chemerinsky was taken from a photograph and that none of his features were exaggerated in any way. The LSJP ultimately removed the bloody fork and knife from the version of the image that had been posted online. "I will never apologize for the poster," she told me. "It was not anti-Semitic, and I think it's an excuse to distract from a much bigger problem." She also rejects the idea that the dinner was an inappropriate venue for protest. She said, "We all have a collective responsibility to insert Palestine and the word genocide everywhere, in every space. I don't think there's an inappropriate time to discuss the genocide." She and her fellow protesters did not expect Fisk or Chemerinsky to react in the way they did, she said. "We thought that this would be a very peaceful walkout that would be a call to action for our peers with a speech that was, quite frankly, very respectful." I asked Chemerinsky whether he or Fisk thought Afanet posed some threat to their safety, which might have provided a rationale for taking the microphone away, even forcibly. Chemerinsky didn't offer a direct reply, but said that the student was being disruptive. Fisk declined to be interviewed for this piece. I asked Chemerinsky whether he thought she had the right to grab the microphone out of Afanet's hand in an aggressive manner. He mostly avoided the question on the phone, but in his later email he said that he had wanted to think before answering directly and provided an unequivocal response. In the context and circumstances, my wife did nothing wrong. The day after the incident, Chemerinsky posted a statement online. The dinners for graduating law students would continue at his home, he wrote, but we will have security present. Any student who disrupts the dinners, he added, will be reported to student conduct, and a violation of the student conduct code is reported to the bar. After all the dinners had been held, the paragraph mentioning security and the reporting to student conduct in the bar were removed. This conflict can seem intractable, but when it comes to the relatively minor matter of campus politics and the appropriate course of action for an academic administration, there is an alternative. 5 days after October 7th, Williams College published a letter from Maud Mandel, its president, in which Mandel announced that neither she nor the school would be making any official statements about what was happening in Israel and Gaza. When I speak as president of Williams, I'm speaking on behalf of thousands of people who together make up the Williams community. I feel it is both right and necessary for me to do so on topics related to our core educational mission. But when the topics are national and world events, even events that affect us personally and on which we feel great moral clarity, I do not believe it is the president's job to speak for the whole community, or even that it is possible to do so. This, I believe, is the correct position, both from a legal and ethical standpoint. Students at a public university should be able to engage in whatever speech acts they would want. Like Chemerinsky, I'm disheartened by what I see as a censorious tilt in campus activism, and do not think it's appropriate for the dean of the law school to be deciding who student groups invite to their events, or dictating who gets to say what. As the dean, Chemerinsky should always default to the most capacious possible interpretation of free speech. His support of the students' right to their bylaws and to keep up the posters shows that he understands this. If a student strays slightly on the wrong side of a thin line, one whose boundaries are certainly debatable, they should not be subject to physical confrontation and a threat to their futures. They're still students, and Chemerinsky and Fisk are still the professors. That is also relevant context. Given all we know now, we can ask ourselves again whether there is any instance in which it would be appropriate for a law professor to put their hands on a student engaged in peaceful, non-threatening action. Does any of the context about the First Amendment or private property or the history of Berkeley LSJP really change your answer to that question? In one of our earlier conversations, Afanet expressed some consternation about being interviewed because she feared that a campus controversy between two privileged individuals in the West could distract from what is happening in Gaza. It does seem fair to ask how much we in the media should cover campus activism, especially after this week of protests at Columbia and the University of Southern California and months of crackdowns on student demonstrations across the country, including at the University of Michigan, Brown, and MIT. Just as I imagine that Fisk and perhaps even Chemerinsky know that no one should have grabbed Afanel on the stairs, I believe that many of us in the media know that we've mostly failed in our coverage of campus protests, especially regarding speech acts that we might find distasteful, pointless, or beyond the pale. There is something undignified about breathlessly scolding young people, particularly when they are seemingly being silenced, as in the case of Asna Tabassum, a Muslim-American student at the University of Southern California, whose valedictory address was canceled on account of vaguely described concerns for safety, or when they're being mass arrested, as they were this week at Columbia University. I'm convinced that one of the reasons these stories get so much attention from those of us in the media is that they require less courage than addressing the actual war, the incalculable loss of life, the horrific images of October 7th, and the recurring reel of carnage out of Gaza. So we funnel our despair and insecurity about those events and our responsibility for them through relentless attention to campus culture. Try to understand, we are doing it not out of malice or even a fixation on the prestige that institutions like Berkeley or Columbia confer, but rather out of the deep insecurity that we do not always know what to say about a profoundly violent world. And perhaps part of us, regardless of what side we're on, feels an unconscious jealousy for young people who do not get tripped up by the technicalities of constitutional debates or slowed down by hand-wringing over circumstances and context. There is always an even larger context that we should not forget. This by J. Caspian Kang. He is a staff writer at The New Yorker. And that is all we have time for today. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This has been The New Yorker Hour. I'll be back with you again next week. Till then, take care, stay safe, and be well. Bye-bye.